sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Bram Presser, a former punk rocker who's the author of the National Jewish Book Award winner debut novel, The Book of Dirt. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shin Shiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I had an interesting experience this past week. Last Saturday night, my trusty cell phone, an iPhone 7, decided without any warning to die. I was on my phone, as usual, checking email and texts and Facebook when the screen suddenly went black. And just like that, I was out of communication with everyone. In 2019, phone failure is an experience both liberating and terrifying. Because so very much of our lives are run through these little devices now, our connections to people and news and work and information are constantly available in our hands, or at worst, in our pockets. Most of us spend a very large percentage of our lives staring into our palms, reading, writing with our thumbs, checking scores or stock prices or gossip or random bits of information we just have to know right now. And suddenly, I was cast back into, well, the last century. That is, the 20th century, when phones were for talking, were mostly wired into the wall, and you had to be in a fixed place to use them. It was quite a strange sensation when my phone died, a little bit like being cut off from the world while I was still sitting there in the middle of the city. After the initial fear that there would be critical and terrible failures, I did foul up two appointments and miss a couple of events, and the sense that I was wasting time because I didn't know the absolute latest news about everything, not having a phone was actually rather freeing. And when the Apple Store said my phone was truly dead forever, and AT&T said the replacement phone wouldn't arrive for at least 3 days, 3 days without a smartphone, by the way, that soon stretched to a week, well, those feelings intensified. I found myself looking at maps to find my way to unfamiliar locations. I had people call me on my landline at home. I still have one of those. And I no longer knew what every batter had done in each inning of every Dodgers game unless I actually watched the game. There was a little sense of tightrope walking without a net, worrying that I had missed something or someone. But when actual emergencies occurred, it turned out people managed to reach me anyway. I wasn't noticeably less productive than I would have been with my phone in hand. Perhaps more so, actually. I was less distracted. And throughout, there was an odd sense of freedom. What's that classic Kris Kristofferson song Janis Joplin sang? Me and Bobby McGee? Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Sometimes, that's true. If you can't do anything about a situation, if you can't text or call or email or Facebook message or Instagram post or blog or find out what you desperately have to know, well then, you are kind of free. No one can tell you what to do. You don't know what somebody thinks you did wrong. You can't take pictures of everything going on in your life. You don't know what ridiculous story has just popped up on your phone. You just have to be present. Here. Now. Well, now we are less than 2 weeks from the beginning of Pesach, Passover, the holiday that celebrates freedom. I'm not saying we are actual slaves to our devices, our iPhones or Samsung Galaxies or whatever multi-purpose electronics we rely on constantly. They don't really govern our lives unless we allow them to do so. But in truth, it is a kind of slavery to a device, as incredibly useful as these are. And being freed from that was a peculiar kind of liberation. Of course, the fact that AT&T still hasn't delivered my new phone has now taken this beyond the joy of being freed from expectations to a level of rather intense personal frustration. I do need that device in order to work effectively and efficiently in the long run and keep track of my kids and congregants and obligations. Sooner or later, I'll go back to using that thing all the time. But this week was a kind of gift. I think that I have a different perspective on the necessity of constantly being online and available now, and maybe a little more insight into freedom. Passover's coming up fast now, the first two nights of Pesach are April 19th and 20th, and that means we're in the period of Passover preparations that precede the festival of Matzah, Maror, and much else. So to play us in this morning as part of our pre-Passover preview of music for Pesach, less than a fortnight before Passover begins, here's Yonatan Razel and Yaakov Shweki singing a song from the Haggadah, V'hi She'amda. This is that promise that sustained our fathers and us. It's not one enemy alone that stood up against us to destroy us, but in each generation there are those who stand up against us to destroy us. The Holy One, blessed be God, saves us from their hand.
שלא אחד בלבד עומד עלינו לחלותינו עומד עלינו לחלותינו
רבו דברנו מצילנו מצילנו
That was V'hi She'amda from the Haggadah for Passover, coming to a Seder near you, Friday night, April 19th and 20th. If you're not going to be at home for Seder, please make a reservation at Congregation Beit Simcha's inaugural First Night Seder at www.beitsimchatucson.org. Our guest this morning is a most unusual author. Bram Presser was a successful Australian punk rocker who decided to write a novel based on, in part, his own family's Jewish story. His first book just won the National Jewish Book Award for fiction, debut fiction, that is, and you'll meet him and hear his extraordinary story in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Bram Presser is the author of the debut novel, The Book of Dirt, which has received a number of awards, in particular the National Jewish Book Award for a first novel. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So you did not start out as a novelist.
No.
To put it mildly, let's say.
Yeah, I started out as a punk rocker, which is a very natural progression, of course, and then via a criminal lawyer and a law professor. So very natural fit, all of these different pursuits.
You know, the next question is, how did your parents feel about these various professional peregrinations?
My parents are are quite amazing. They're incredibly supportive, and they actually turned up to every punk show we did when they were in the same city.
Oh my.
I think it was probably like for them, you know, they at least knew throughout it I was, like, you know, studying law, and then I was, you know, practicing and in academia, so they could at least tell their friends I was doing that rather than the other stuff.
Yeah, it's okay. He's a lawyer. Don't worry
that's
about
right.
The Yid Corps stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Along the way, by the way, lots of lawyers become writers. You do a lot of writing in law.
Absolutely.
This is a very Jewish and a very interesting book. One of the challenges, I think, is there are so many great books have been written about the Holocaust, about the aftermath of the Shoah, and so on. This is a very interesting, very different take on that. Tell us how you decided to write the Book of Dirt, what your motivations were.
Well, I mean, my grandparents were you know, the kind of survivors who didn't talk, weren't able to talk, so we never knew their story. And then a few years after they died within about six weeks of one another, a few years afterwards, an article was published claiming that my grandfather had been picked by the Nazis as the literary curator of Hitler's Museum of the Extinct Race. Hmm. So I actually just really set about trying to find out whether that story was true. And it was really just kind of a personal... I had no intention of writing a book. I just wanted to you know, to learn about it. I was very close with him. So I set off on this journey. I just kind of was keeping notes as I was doing it. I really didn't get anywhere very quickly. So I just started playing around with them as characters. And I found that I was really getting to know them in quite a meaningful way through fiction. And then, as it happened, a whole lot of gates opened, and I suddenly had a lot of the records and documents and photos. But I wanted to stick with the kind of fictional incarnations of them. And so I basically did both. I documented in the book the story of how I came to, you know, learn their stories, and I set that against a reimagining of the stories through a lens of myth and legend, you know, Jewish and Czech, which I was pretty much brought up on.
You know, it's fascinating, and we'll talk about the style of the book, which is a mix. You sometimes aren't quite sure what's real and what's not. Mystical, complicated, really interesting book. We'll return in just a moment with Bram Presser and his remarkable debut novel, The Book of Dirt, here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha is creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, cultural Jewish programming, and festivals. Our magnificent Beit Simcha home at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard is on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, just across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell. Shabbat services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 with services afterwards at 10 a.m. And join us for our inaugural first night Passover Seder, Friday, April 19th at 6 p.m. A fantastic experience of the Feast of Freedom in song, story, food, and celebration. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha and to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course our Seder, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675, 276-5675, or BEITSIMCHA, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its fast-growing, exciting beginning. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we've been talking about some Jewish communities that are today perhaps obscure, in which they're smaller, maybe there isn't much left there, and yet they're where so many of our ancestors came from. And you were mentioning that it's a good thing to kind of get out of your comfort zone and go visit some of these places, see where you really come from. But you tied it to the Seder somehow, so tell us about that.
Right. We'll do in just a second. One of the things I've noticed when I lead groups is, for example, the last trip I took, we went to Lviv in the northwest corner of Ukraine, which used to be part of Austro-Hungary. It was called Lemberg in German. And in Russian, it's called Lvov, and it means like the city of lions, Leopolis.
It's like Lyon.
Right, sure. But this is a city that once had, you know, 250,000 Jews, 72 synagogues. Now it has maybe 1,500 Jews, if you count them generously, two synagogues that barely function. It's a flicker. And the missing population is like an open hole in the heart and soul of the city. But still, that's a big city with comfortable hotels and all the creature comforts of home. A lot of people in the group went from there either over the border into Poland or into southern Ukraine, into the Bukovina, to look at the places their parents or grandparents came from. And these were often like all-day trips that involved a train and a taxi or a car with an unknown driver, whatever, and a certain amount of discomfort and an uncertainty as to whether you could get a decent meal. Not the greatest roads in the world, you can't make good time, whatever. And certainly people who do this left their comfort zones, but they came back, each and every one of them, from these days outside their comfort zones with a remarkable feeling of satisfaction and connectedness to their own past, both as an individual, as a family, and as part of Am Yisrael, the people of Israel. So the connection for me to the Passover Seder is, after we ask the four questions, the major chunk, the meat of the Seder, is the Magid, like telling the story, which is a lengthy, very verbose attempt to answer the four questions. And one of the early paragraphs, if not the first paragraph, begins with a weird phrase, Tse Ulmad, go out and learn. In ordinary day-to-day Hebrew, you or I would say, Lech Ulmad, go and learn. Tse Ulmad means go out and learn, Latzit. Well, from what? We talk about Yitziat Mitzrayim, going out from Egypt.
Kind of an exodus.
So maybe it's related to that.
Right.
But in my view, and this is what I want your listeners to come away from this with, it's to really learn and really change and experience something new, you have to leave your comfort zone. You have to go out of what is familiar. And so in terms of travel, that means if you go on some tour that's only big cities and comfortable hotels, you're not going to really make the kinds of connections and discoveries and important learning that you will make if you leave your comfort zone, go to difficult places where maybe your grandparents or great-grandparents actually once lived their lives, and spend time in those places.
I think it's a great instruction, and it's part of being Jewish is to, you know, we weren't wandering Jews by accident entirely. So much of it was trying to find ourselves in different places and discovering there what our core values really were. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
As we approach Passover, Marge Piercy's wonderful poem, part of her Pesach Seder cycle, is entitled Salt Water. You can use it at your Seder. It is a bowl of tears on the table into which we dip the parsley, into which we dip the egg. A miniature ocean on the table, salt as the sea of reeds through which they were to pass. Not to safety, never safety, but to where they were promised they would, if they chose, be free. It is the salt water of our sweat, pressed through our skin as the body labors. For we are bidden not only to rest on the seventh day, but work on the others. And the brain, too, in its fever of creation, exudes salt like the sea, salt like our blood, salt like the waters of the womb, the salt of regret, and the salt of effort. Marge Piercy's poem, Saltwater, for Pesach, coming up less than 2 weeks. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one, courtesy of our recent guest, comedian Rabbi Bob Alper. A young Jewish woman fulfills her parents' dreams by going to medical school and becoming a doctor. She does her residency on a Native American reservation in far northern Arizona. There she falls in love with a Navajo man and elopes with him. Her parents, who always expected her to marry a nice Jewish man, are shocked. They become estranged. But one day, a year or two later, she calls her parents. Mom, Dad, I wanted to tell you we just had a baby, and we want his name to honor both of his heritages, Native American and Jewish. We decided to name him Whitefish. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, even if I just heard that for the first time 2 weeks ago. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benekot, representing the Weintraub Israel Center and Israel. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Pesach is coming, holiday of
yay!
Not only freedom and matzah and spring, but cleaning.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what Pesach meant in your homes in Israel.
So my family, like my close family, isn't really religious, but it was a great opportunity to do a makeover in the house and start cleaning, even when you're not really cleaning for chametz, because we left chametz in the house. We would still like clean all the house and do makeovers and stuff because everyone does it, so it's a great opportunity. So even though it wasn't for Pesach, we would clean the house like all those 2 weeks. Like we would clean it a lot, and we used to host a lot, so you have to clean
you
for
have to
that.
Clean, of course, because yeah. You don't want guests to see how you actually live.
Yeah, we used to hide all the chametz in like a closet, and we're like, yeah, yeah, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. But yeah, so we would do that just for it.
Now the truth's coming out. We're getting all the secrets of
your
home.
Sorry, family.
So, Ron, tell us about your home getting ready for Pesach.
So I'm really used to that in Pesach, my grandma, she always cleaned the entire house. Really, it's spotless. And if you just want to get into the house, she has to check that you don't have any chametz on you. You can't eat anything. She doesn't know what that is. She really likes it. And we all know not to mess with her around that time because obviously it's really stressful to clean and there's a lot of things to do. And I really like that... The fire that you do, I don't
to
know.
To burn the biur chametz.
Can, yeah,
burn
chametz.
The chametz. Yeah. The chametz, of course, is the non-kosher for Passover stuff. Bread, donuts, crackers, any of this stuff that's made with wheat or barley or rye or spelt or any of the other grains.
So we used to make it out of like a thing, like a family thing.
So like a bonfire kind
of? Yeah, we used to do a bonfire and everyone used to come. We used to do dinner. It was really fun.
So it's almost like a Lag BaOmer in advance.
Yes, exactly.
That's nice. Did you guys burn your chametz? You kept the chametz in a closet so you could sneak it during Pesach.
Yeah. So when we won't like host family, we just like, you know, keep it. But we did it, like my dad's side of the family is religious, so we did it when we were little in their house, in my grandma and grandpa's house. We did it in our school sometimes. They took us to this, like, museums that talk about Pesach. Like, I don't really remember.
How interesting.
Yeah, and they, like, gave us, like, fake candles or something. Said, look for the chametz in the house.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was like, yeah, it was like
Bedikat chametz. You're supposed to search for it. Exactly. Why? I never understood in this day and age, why not use a really bright LED flashlight? Yeah. If you really want to find the chametz, a little candle and a wooden spoon is kind of mishigash. But
keep it traditional.
It's traditional. And a feather, because a feather is more efficient than a vacuum cleaner, of course. Well, lots of nice memories, and we'll talk about Pesach itself because the cleaning is just the preparation, at least in theory. I don't want to say Chag Sameach, it's too early, but good preparations.
Yeah, good preparations.
Bye-bye, have a nice week.
Lihitraot. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Mitzorah in the book of Leviticus, and a wholly unappetizing section it is. Mitzorah focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world. It's true, leprosy was an awful thing and needed to be eliminated, if at all possible, in particular by using quarantines to isolate it. But exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length in a Shabbat service could scarcely be called a spiritually meaningful experience. The rabbis of our tradition recognized the problem long ago, came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word mitzorah, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew motzi shem ra, which means slander or evil speech. Their interpretation was based on evidence in the Torah itself. Moses' hand became leprous when he expressed doubt about the willingness of the people to believe in his mission, while Miriam was struck by leprosy when she spoke against Moses. The leper was a person who talked badly about others. Evil speech, Lashon Hara, and its even darker partner, Motzi Shem Ra, slander, were considered by the sages to be among the worst sins of all. What needed to be eliminated from society was not just the biological illness of leprosy, but these terrible infections of slander and gossip. The ways in which we employ language lead to many of the worst problems of our society. Lashon Hara, Maimonides taught, is not only a terrible epidemic disease, but even a multiple murderer, killing three people. The one who shares the gossip, the one who hears the gossip, and the one who is the subject of gossip. According to Jewish law, even gossip with a kernel of truth within it is Lashon Hara, and inherently wrong, and causes intense societal damage. Some authorities, such as the great rabbi known as the Chofetz Chaim, go so far as to say that even gossiping about the truth is morally heinous. There is a parallel in our own law code in the United States. There's a legal concept in American jurisprudence called the fruit of the poisoned tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected improperly. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and not legally admissible. So it is with Mitzorah and all other forms of Lashon Hara, evil speech. Whether gossip has elements of truth in it or not, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupted source. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, the awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. The rabbis teach that if you commit no slander, your own life can become clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that damage others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. Our portion this week even delineates forms of Mitzorah that affect the very houses in which we live, Mitzorah Bait. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of property, it may even need to be destroyed. It's along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. If we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, communities, and nations in which holiness can flourish and good prevail, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated as well. May we each do our part now and always to remove Metsora, personal impurities of speech, from our own lives, our institutions, our community, and, God willing, our country. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Bram Presser, will tell us how he created his remarkable new novel, The Book of Dirt, over a multi-year period of research and exploration. It's a great story. Hear it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Although we are 18 months away, 18 long months from the 2020 U.S. presidential election, I'm afraid it might almost be time to start our Jewish presidential election segment soon. There are clearly efforts being made already to swing Jewish voters towards one party or the other. The Republican effort was first called Jexodus and has been renamed the Exodus Movement. That seems seasonal, at least, if not very accurate. 79% of Jews voted Democratic in the midterm elections last November. Anyway, what was interesting was that Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker of New Jersey, about whom I really don't know very much, to be honest, appeared in a CNN town hall last week and said all of this.
And on President Trump's first Muslim ban, I remember running out to the airport where I saw the whole concourse full of Americans yelling and chanting and singing patriotic slogans as people came into this country, like Abraham welcoming strangers in the desert. And one of the best sights I've ever saw was a bunch of Jewish Americans with yarmulkes and tzitzis hanging out, cheering and dancing as Muslim countries came into this community. Fundamental to Islam, to Christianity, to the Torah, to Sikh and Hindu Americans is this ideal of creating a beloved community. There's a song sung during the high holidays, Ki Beiti Beit Tefillah L'chol Ha'amim, may my house be a house of prayer for many nations. We are the United States of America. We were not formed as a theocracy. We were formed on the ideal that many of us in our diversity can come together and create one strong whole, e pluribus unum. And if I am president of the United States, I will fight every day to put more indivisible into this one nation under God.
Wow, that's a lot of knowledge of Jews and Judaism for a devout Christian politician, including easily throwing out the words tzitzis and yarmulkes, pronounced correctly and fluidly. His Hebrew pronunciation may not be perfect, but I'm pretty sure most Jews don't even know the quote he used from 2 Isaiah chapter 56, verse 7. Ki veiti beit tefillah yikare l'chol ha'amim. My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. Apparently, Cory Booker became friends with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, a past guest of Two Jewish multiple times, while Booker was studying at Oxford University, where Boteach was then the very influential Chabad rabbi. They exchanged books. Booker says he gave Boteach books by James Baldwin and W.B. Du Bois, and Boteach gave him Hillel. Good trade. In any case, it's certainly one of the very first times I can recall a candidate for president of the U.S. using more than a couple of words of Hebrew, especially when he or she wasn't in Israel, Joe Lieberman accepted. Pretty surprising. I guess I need to find out more about Cory Booker. The other news stories this week come from the Kotel, the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro visited the Western Wall alongside Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu last week. He became the first head of state to do so with an Israeli prime minister. The visit came when Bolsonaro, sworn in as Brazil's president January 1st, arrived for a three-day trip to Israel. The Kotel, of course, is the holiest site in all of Judaism, located in East Jerusalem, which Israel reunited with West Jerusalem during the 1967 Six-Day War and later annexed. Such visits can be seen as granting tacit approval to Israeli sovereignty over the old city. Imagine that. Bolsonaro's visit follows a similar one by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on March 21st, when he became the first high-ranking American official to visit the Western Wall along with an Israeli prime minister. Bolsonaro has expressed his strong support for Israel and spoke of being moved by a Christian pilgrimage to the Jordan River he undertook a couple of years ago. Bolsonaro also pledged to follow U.S. President Donald Trump in moving Brazil's Israel embassy to Jerusalem. Moving the embassy would please Bolsonaro's evangelical Christian support base, but risk provoking commercial retaliation from Arab states, some of which are major importers of Brazilian meat. Instead of announcing the embassy move, Bolsonaro said his government would open a trade, technology, and innovation office in Jerusalem. Netanyahu said, "I'm going to tell you a secret. I hope this is the first step towards the opening, when the time comes, of a Brazilian embassy in Jerusalem." He and Bolsonaro were giving statements to journalists. The announcement of a new Brazilian office in Jerusalem led the Palestinian Authority to recall its ambassador to Brazil for consultations. And as happens twice a year, the stones of the Western Wall were inspected for stability last week. The Western Wall Heritage Foundation does a thorough inspection prior to Pesach and before Rosh Hashanah. The inspection includes the stones and the Wilson's Arch covered area, among other areas. The stones were cleaned, loose particles and other debris removed. Last July, a 400-pound stone fell from the Western Wall to the egalitarian prayer plaza near Robinson's Arch. As it also does during these inspections, the Western Wall Heritage Foundation removes the notes placed between the stones of the Western Wall. That removal will happen April 10th, this coming week. The Ptakim, the personal notes of prayers of request to God placed into the Kotel, are actually treated as sacred objects and buried in a geniza. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Bram Presser. His new book is called The Book of Dirt. It's his debut novel, won the National Jewish Book Award for debut fiction. He is originally from Melbourne, Australia, an incredible Jewish community, by the way. Fronted a Jewish punk rock band, Yidkor, and was a singing voice for an Australian star in a movie. Went to law school, became a lawyer, and now he's become a novelist.
When you say it, it just sounds very weird.
Yeah, really, it does sound kind of weird, doesn't it?
I have to say, it's a colorful life already. It sounds like somebody should write a novel about you.
God forbid. I don't want people digging up my secrets.
No, you don't want to give it up that way.
One of the fascinating parts about the Book of Dirt, dealing with the whole question of the Czech Jewish community, there's a myth that we were all taught, only to discover it's not so true, that while the Nazis were collecting all kinds of Jewish objects and preserving synagogues in Prague, they were doing it for the Museum of Extinct Peoples or Extinct Races. That's a myth, isn't it?
Yeah, so look, it's really interesting. If you go to Prague now and you take the tour of the Jewish quarter, you will still be told that, right? And so there's this, it is, you know, popular, you know, knowledge, I would say, that there was the Nazis were planning this museum of the extinct race. What it turns out, and it's interesting, if you actually go and speak with the museum on a kind of a non-tourist level, that they're quite open about, is that the Nazis did collect things. Like they were collecting Judaica. Some of it was to sell, to help fund the war effort. Some of it was to, just keep it and catalogue. But there was no grand plan to make a museum. And what's, I guess, frustrating for me is that what this idea of the Museum of the Extinct Race gives credit to the Nazis for something which was actually an incredibly chutzpahdic and impressive and really courageous move by the Jewish museum workers of Prague during the occupation. Not many people realized, but the Nazis allowed the Jewish museum to continue to function. And they realized quite early on what was going on, and that the Nazis were wiping out all the satellite communities, and that, you know, the time would come when they wiped out the major cities as well. And they wanted to collect a representative collection of that would show what Jewish life was like during before
the war, before the Holocaust,
because they assumed that they would be killed as well.
Right.
So they wanted this collection to live on as a testament to them and as a testament to what they saw as likely being an extinct race, that being, you know, European Jewry, and that
that was explained in an interview post-war by Hanna Volovkova, who was the first director of the Jewish Museum of Prague after the war. And it was misunderstood by the journalist, who then went on to say that the Nazis had planned a museum of the extinct race. And that just caught on. And it's kind of like being this, well, essentially a golem that can't be stopped.
Yeah, and, somehow seems appropriate for Prague.
Well, exactly. And it's really, it's kind of disappointing because these museum workers were what they managed to achieve in collecting and what they managed to achieve in essentially tricking the Nazis into allowing them to get all of the Judaea from all around occupied Europe was extraordinary. And they should be getting the credit. But instead, there's just this idea that the Nazis had planned this museum, and that's become the popular idea, and people still talk about it. And the number of people that I have argued with, I was once...
I had this argument with my father, actually. You know, he's like, oh, well, that's what we knew. It's like, well, it didn't happen to be true.
In Melbourne, I was giving a talk, and a woman stands up, and she says, I was there. I'm from Prague. I know it's true. And I'm like, well, what do you say to someone who's a survivor,
sure,
who has believed this myth?
Right.
And I'm not going to stand in public and argue with a survivor.
Exactly. Of course.
But like, it's just interesting, and I think about it with my grandfather a lot because I think he probably believed it because it explained to him, or would have explained to him, what he was doing, or the purpose of what he was doing, which was cataloguing books in what was known as the Talmud Commando in Theresienstadt. And, it would have been kind of, I don't know, senseless, I suppose, or purposeless, if it didn't have a grander scheme. And so when he heard about this museum of the extinct race, he probably just went, oh, yeah, that must have been what I was doing.
Yeah. You know, in your book, you have a great deal of the, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, you did the research, you didn't have any information, then you got some information, you include it, and it's sometimes challenging to know what's real and what's fictional in the way you present it. There's photos, there's documents, there's handwritten letters. Tell us about how that evolved, and I don't know if you can tell us what's true and what's invented.
Well, I would say, of the quest narrative, the me searching for the stories, I would say 90% of it is true. Mm-hmm. It is as it happened, and I sort of don't hold back. I was not the most savvy researcher through a lot of it, and like you also have to imagine, I was turning up to these places. I was still a lot of the for the first half of it at least. I still was in full punk rock regalia, so you know, people weren't taking me very seriously. And even now, I mean, I've got dreadlocks that kind of almost come to the floor, and so you know, people still find it hard to take me seriously. But so that was kind of a difficulty. But all of the parts that are reimagined, I mean, look, there's a magical.
I just want to make sure that everybody can see your dreadlocks here on radio because. It's...
Yes, exactly. I'm holding them out.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you. Like, that's great.
Looking and laughing. Yeah. There's a magical realist thread through the book, you know, to do with the golem. And that is obviously, imagination. But all of the kind of narrative anecdotes, I suppose, for want of a better term, are dramatizations of things that I was told. There are a whole lot of episodes, ones that stand out to me, I suppose, are like, you know, when I found out that my grandmother lived a couple doors down from where the paratroopers hid after the Heydrich assassination. So she would have seen when the Nazis came to arrest, I mean, the paratroopers had already moved on, but they ended up arresting the people who were hiding them. There's a scene where she witnesses the Gestapo and the Nazis coming to arrest their neighbours.
Right.
There's my grandmother was happened to be arrive in Auschwitz the day before the Sonderkommando uprising, and she was the subcamp she was housed in or imprisoned in was the closest one to the crematoria that was destroyed. So she would have seen that as well. Like, so those sort of things. And even like minor anecdotes, like my great grandfather was a kind of, well, a drunken gambler, basically, and his wife, who was not Jewish and converted before marriage, and you know, and by Nazi standards after that point, still wasn't Jewish, even though you know, to us she was, and so there was this story that they were saving up for a car, and she. And she, you know, she thought they were putting away payments. It turned out he was actually gambling them away and didn't tell her until the last payment was due, when kind of he didn't have a car. And she realized that he'd essentially ruined the family. So all these sort of stories, they're, as far as I know, true, or the best approximation of truth that I could come up with from the evidence. So an example would be, I know that my grandparents met in Theresienstadt, right? Or actually, I knew they had met in concentration camp. And so, I, based on the dates of where they were at any time, because, you know, I have all the records, I knew that the only concentration camp they were in at the same time was Theresienstadt. And I knew that my grandfather had known my grandmother's mother. Right? Sorry, my grandmother had known my grandfather's mother. And there's a kind of a famous, I suppose, family, it's, you know, part of the family law, L-O-R-E, that is.
Hard word for an Australian to say and be understood in America. That's right.
That my grandmother decided that she would marry my grandfather because she saw the way he treated his mother when she was taken away on a transport, right? And so I worked out that the likely way they would have known each other, or the possibly the only way they would have known each other or met each other, was if my grandmother had been in the same barracks as my grandfather's mother. And so
Just kind of put those two together.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, there's a couple of chapters in the book where, and because one of the things I found most interesting in writing the book was I really had this kind of pressing need or desire to write about what life was like in the camps, rather than just these kind of, you know, these horror templates that we're brought up on. But people were actually living lives. They had, you know, micro societies. They were in horrific circumstances, but they were there for a long time. And they, you know, and it wasn't actually until I saw that film Son of Saul that I realized that, you know, people were trying to still live lives. And so I really wanted to kind of humanize the experience of life in the camps. And so, that, you know, having just these women meet in you know, in a barracks, and my grandfather's mother sort of takes my grandmother under her wing a bit, and they're just, you know, them kind of sitting around eating, and because my grandmother was having food sent in from her mother still in Prague, and so she was obviously, she had better you know, rations and conditions than most people in the camp who didn't have an outside source of food, and so, you know, just these kind of, you know, the day to day, you know, my grandmother being in love with her neighbour, who was also in the camp. Those sort of things were really important to me in writing it.
The you know, it's an odd detail, but not such a detail. The fact that they're busy cataloging and organizing these Jewish books in Theresienstadt, by the way, two of the most famous camps, of course, Theresienstadt and Auschwitz. It's such a weird, obviously true detail. You know, one of the ironies of the book is, of course, anybody who survived was kind of miraculous, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like people are living lives of purpose in the midst of this horror.
Which I think is really important, because I think it gives agency back to the survivors who, you know, for the most part, the way the stories are told, they just went through a machine, basically. But no, like, I think it's very important to show that they were able to live purposefully and to actually have meaning in their lives in such a horrible environment, even in Auschwitz.
There's a quote in the book from a survivor, I assume it's a true quote, in which it sounds like she's telling you, stop the obsession, stop the search, do not let it take over your life. Apparently that she failed.
Yeah. Well, actually, it came quite late in the writing of the book. I mean, the book took 8 years to write, and that probably happened at about year six. Mm-hmm. And what had happened was I was speaking to a guy I know who was the director of the Holocaust Museum in Melbourne. And he said, oh, actually, there's a survivor you should speak to, because she was in Theresienstadt, and, you know, she might have known. Yeah, if you want her to fill in some details. So I actually sat down with her, an amazing woman, and she just looked at me. And to be fair, at that point, I really was in a bad way. This book, I had a breakdown while writing it. It really took a lot out of me.
By the way, this should be a warning to all, you know, aspiring novelists.
Exactly. It's great when you come out the other side. But,
yeah. Well, and you're getting awards and the book's selling and it's great, but boy, it's not an easy process.
No, it is not an easy time. Or either that, or maybe just, you know, write some light fantasy or something instead. But so she could see it straight away. And like, we hadn't even started talking. She just looked at me and she goes, you know, before we start, just stop. Like I can see this is destroying you. Just let it go. Of course, I can't. It's just not even my nature. But she was right. Like, and it is also, you know, this, particularly when you're writing your own family story, it's so hard to, like, I basically brought them back to life just to put them back through hell. And that's a really kind of difficult thing. Like, you know, there was one part of me which was kind of reveling in the fact that I essentially got to spend time again with my grandparents. I was incredibly close with them, which I think made this kind of idea of realizing that I didn't know them at all were quite incredible, and why I felt so driven to find out the story. But I don't know, like, it's just so, you know, I couldn't let go. I just had to keep going.
Well, it's an extraordinary book. Reminding me, just a little bit of everything is illuminated in the way you cut back and forth, but I think authentic and unique in its own way, in which Dirt is an important character. I'll leave that to the readers to find out. Bram, where can people find out more about you? Where can they find out more about the book?
So they can go to my website, brampresser.com, or just find me on Facebook or Twitter. And the book is available in lots of bookstores, I hope. Like, certainly in Australia it is, and hopefully it is here now, and hopefully we'll get more in more now that it's won the award.
Absolutely.
And also Amazon, you know, the usual online outlets.
And of course, wherever books are sold, which is mostly Amazon. I want to thank Bram Presser for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Mazel tov on the award, and we look forward to your next, hopefully not 8-year-long torturous project.
That's what my editor said. He goes, can you try something shorter that won't take 8 years?
The follow-up. Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Natalie Silverstein, author of Simple Acts, The Busy Family's Guide to Giving Back. And sign up now for our inaugural First Night Seder at Congregation Beit Simcha, coming up fast, April 19th, a beautiful freedom feast of song, story, food, and meaning. Of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover musical preview for Pesach, the festival coming up April 19th, less than 2 weeks. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for that great First Night Seder. This is from 613, the a cappella group, parodying The Shape of You as My Seder Crew. Uh-huh. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
I cleaned the house and got rid of the chametz. Now the Seder's where I go. Me and my fam at the table eating matzah like the Hebrews long ago. So come over, we start Passover Seder by blessing the wine. Then we wash in our hands. Then we grab parsley, dip it in the salt water, and break the middle matzah in half.
And now we're singing like, girl, you know I want matzah. butter was handmade by my father before me. Thanking God that we were freed, led out of slavery in Mitzrayim. Said, boys, now we'll drink four cups, spill for the place and go on with the Magid. Thanking God that we were freed, thanking God that we were freed.
I'm feeling love from my Seder crew. Gonna rock out the Dayenu, Chagadya and Nadiru, next year in Yerushalayim. Tonight family fills the room, and the kitchen smells like soup. For 8 days we're saying thank you to God who took us out of Mitzrayim. He took us out of Mitzrayim. For 8 days we're saying thank you to God who took us out of Mitzrayim.
Questions again before the meal can begin, and eat the matzah our fathers ate. They had to leave swiftly, no time to add yeast. Now we've got unleavened bread on the plate. Take a bite of the Mara so we remember the...
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.